Chapter 42. Blank and with a bitterness she disregarded. She even answered my question quite readily with many words out of which I could make very little. I only learned that for at least 5 mixed reasons, none of which impressed me profoundly, Dona Rita had started at a moment's notice from Paris with nothing but a dressing bag, and permitting Rose to go and visit her aged parents for 2 days, and then follow her mistress. That girl of late had looked so perturbed and worried, that the sensitive Rita, fearing that she was tired of her place, proposed to settle a sum of money on her which would have enabled her to devote herself entirely to her aged parents. And did I know what that extraordinary girl said? She had said, "Aunt, let Madame think that I would be too proud to accept anything whatever from her, but I can't even dream of leaving Madame. I believe Madame has no friends. Not one." So instead of a large sum of money, Dona Rita gave the girl a kiss, and as he had been worried by several people who wanted her to go to Tolosa, she bolted down this way, just to get clear of all those busybodies. "I'd from them," she went on with ardor. "S, I came here to hide," she repeated twice, as if delighted at last, to have hit on that reason among so many others. "How could I tell that you would be here?" Then with sudden fire which only added to the delight with which I had been watching the play of her physiognomy, she added, "Why did you come into this room?" She enchanted me. The ardent modulations of the sound, the slight play of the beautiful lips, the still, deep sapphire gleam in those long eyes inherited from the dawn of ages, and that seemed always to watch unimaginable things, that underlying faint ripple of gaiety, that played under all her moods, as though it had been a gift from the high gods moved to pity for this lonely mortal, all this within the four walls, and displayed for me alone gave me the sense of almost intolerable joy. The words didn't matter. They had to be answered, of course. "I came in for several reasons. One of them is that I didn't know you were here."
"Therese didn't tell you?"
"No. Never talked to you about me?" I hesitated only for a moment. "Ever," I said. Then I asked in my turn, "Did she tell you I was here?"
"No," she said.
It's very clear she did not mean us to come together again.
Neither did I, my dear.
"What do you mean by speaking like this, in this tone, in these words? You seem to use them, as if they were a sort of formula. Am I a dear to you? Or is anybody, or everybody?" As he had been for some time raised on her elbow, but then as if something had happened to her vitality, she sank down till her head rested again on the sofa cushion. "Why do you try to hurt my feelings?" she asked. "For the same reason for which you call me dear at the end of a sentence like that. For want of something more amusing to do. You don't pretend to make me believe that you do it for any sort of reason that a decent person would confess to." The color had gone from her face, but a fit of wickedness was on me and I pursued, "What are the motives of your speeches? What prompts your actions? On your own showing, your life seems to be a continuous running away. You have just run away from Paris. Where will you run tomorrow? What are you everlastingly running from, or is it that you are running after something? What is it? A man, a phantom or some sensation that you don't like to own to?" Truth to say, I was abashed by the silence which was her only answer to this sally. I said to myself that I would not let my natural anger, my just fury be disarmed by any assumption of pathos or dignity. I suppose I was really out of my mind, and what in the Middle Ages would have been called possessed by an evil spirit. I went on enjoying my own villainy. "Why aren't you in Tolosa? You ought to be in Tolosa. Isn't Tolosa the proper field for your abilities, for your sympathies, for your profusions, for your generosities, the king without a crown, the man without a fortune? But here there is nothing worthy of your talents." "No, there is no longer anything worth any sort of trouble here. There isn't even that ridiculous Monsieur George. I understand that the talk of the coast from here to Set is that Monsieur George is drowned. Upon my word, I believe he is. And serve him right too. There's Therese,
but I don't suppose that your love for your sister. Dot, for goodness' sake don't let her come in and find you here. Those words recalled me to myself, exorcised the evil spirit by the mere enchanting power of the voice. They were also impressive by their suggestion of something practical, utilitarian, and remote from sentiment. The evil spirit left me, and I remained taken aback slightly. Well, I said, if you mean that you want me to leave the room, I will confess to you that I can't very well do it yet. But I could lock both doors, if you don't mind that. Do what you like, as long as you keep her out. You two together would be too much for me tonight. Why don't you go and lock those doors? I have a feeling she is on the prowl. I got up at once saying, I imagine as he has gone to bed by this time. I felt absolutely calm and responsible. I turned the keys one after another so gently that I couldn't hear the click of the locks myself. This done, I recrossed the room with measured steps, with downcast eyes, and approaching the couch without raising them from the carpet, I sank down on my knees and leaned my forehead on its edge. That penitential attitude had but little remorse in it. I detected no movement and heard no sound from her. In one place a bit of the fur coat touched my cheek softly, but no forgiving hand came to rest on my bowed head. I only breathed deeply the faint scent of violets, her own particular fragrance enveloping my body, penetrating my very heart with an inconceivable intimacy, bringing me closer to her than the closest embrace, and yet so subtle that I sensed her existence in me only as a great, glowing, indeterminate tenderness, something like the evening light disclosing after the white passion of the day infinite depths in the colors of the sky, and an unsuspected soul of peace in the protean forms of life. I had not known such quietness for months, and I detected, in myself, an immense fatigue, a longing to remain where I was without changing my position to the end of time. Indeed, to remain seemed to me a complete solution for all the problems that life presents, even as to the very death itself. Only the unwelcome reflection that this was impossible made me get up at last with a sigh of deep grief at the end of the dream. But I got up without despair. She didn't murmur, she didn't stir. There was something august in the stillness of the room. It was a strange peace which she shared with me in this unexpected shelter full of disorder in its neglected splendor. What troubled me was the sudden, as it were material, consciousness of time passing as water flows. It seemed to me that it was only the tenacity of my sentiment that held that woman's body, extended and tranquil above the flood. But when I ventured at last to look at her face, I saw her flushed, her teeth clenched, it was visible her nostrils dilated, and in her narrow, level glancing eyes a look of inward and frightened ecstasy. The edges of the fur coat had fallen open, and I was moved to turn away. I had the same impression, as on the evening we parted, that something had happened which I did not understand. Only this time I had not touched her at all. I really didn't understand. At the slightest whisper I would now have gone out without a murmur, as though that emotion had given her the right to be obeyed. But there was no whisper, and for a long time I stood leaning on my arm, looking into the fire and feeling distinctly between the four walls of that locked room the unchecked time flow past our two stranded personalities. And suddenly she spoke. She spoke in that voice, that was so profoundly moving without ever being sad, a little wistful perhaps, and always the supreme expression of her grace. She asked as if nothing had happened. What are you thinking of, amigo? I turned about. She was lying on her side, tranquil above the smooth flow of time, again closely wrapped up in her fur, her head resting on the old gold sofa cushion bearing, like everything else in that room, the decoratively endless letters of her monogram. Her face a little pale now, with the crimson lobe of her ear under the tawny mist of her loose hair, the lips a little parted, and her glance of melted sapphire level and motionless, darkened by fatigue. Can I think of anything but you? I murmured, taking a seat near the foot of the couch. Or rather, it isn't thinking, it is more like the consciousness of you always being present in me, complete to the last hair, to the faintest shade of expression, and that not only when we are apart, but when we are together, alone, as close as this. I see you now lying on this couch, but that is only the insensible phantom of the real you that is in me. And it is the easier for me to feel this, because that image which others see, and call by your name, how am I to know that it is anything else, but an enchanting mist? You have always eluded me except in one, or two moments which seem still more dreamlike than the rest. Since I came into this room you have done nothing to destroy my conviction of your unreality apart from myself. You haven't offered me your hand to touch. Is it because you suspect that apart from me, you are but a mere phantom, and that you fear to put it to the test? One of her hands was under the fur, and the other under her cheek. She made no sound. She didn't offer to stir. She didn't move her eyes, not even after I had added after waiting for a while, just what I expected. You are a cold illusion. She smiled mysteriously, right away from me, straight at the fire, and that was all. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.